Welcome to CFRI's Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Everyone knows who you are.
All right. Well, I want to just start by, as others have, and say it's a sincere privilege to be here with you. I'm always so impressed when I get to spend some time with people who either personally or professionally involved in cystic fibrosis. And so I was asked today to come and speak a little bit about microbiology and some of the related respiratory infection issues, and specifically any concern of emerging pathogens. I don't know that we have, thankfully, too many new or emerging pathogens of great concern right now, but we do have some that are getting increased attention. And so when I consider what might be broadly appealing to the audience today, I came up with three topics, and I'll run through those in just a moment, just briefly in way of disclosures. So the three topics that I will be covering today in the next 45 minutes or so are, first, non-tuberculous mycobacteria. This is not a new infection in the CF world or even outside of CF, but it is getting increased attention and has been a growing concern in recent years. The second is a phenotype or a form of Staph aureus. Staph is the most common infection that we see in the airways of people with CF. And there's a particular type of Staph called small colony variant that has been increasingly recognized as a potential concern even in some of our healthiest and youngest patients. And so we want to talk a little bit about that today. And then wrapping up with a third topic of how can we best use some of our current antibiotics that we use quite a lot in the U.S. and even abroad, and specifically azithromycin and inhaled antibiotic therapy. So let's start with non-tuberculous mycobacteria. These are very commonly found in the natural environment. They exist in water and particularly soil, and they're very hardy. They have this slow-growing property, and they have this very thick, waxy coat. For both of those reasons, they can survive in these natural environments quite well, but it also makes them very difficult to treat with antibiotics when they infect human beings, and we need to address that. We think about them in CF for obvious reasons, and this is the most obvious one. People who have CF are about 3,000 times more likely than the general population to get an infection or to grow one of these from their lungs. The two primary NTM infections we think about are these, avium and abscessus. So Mycobacterium avium, often called MAC, and Mycobacterium abscessus. And I'll just briefly mention, these have now been subdivided by the geneticists into a few different species that are distinct. It doesn't matter for the sake of this talk today, and we'll refer to them as avium or MAC and abscessus. The point that is relevant today, and I want to make very clearly up front, is this. So should you or your loved one grow one of these mycobacteria from a respiratory specimen, that does not mean that it is causing you lung damage or problems to your health. And that's an issue we're still wrestling with and working through. It's a very important question, but one should not immediately panic if this turns to be positive in one of their cultures. Because it is so relatively common, though, in people with CF, it is recommended that we screen for this. And so here in the North America and also in Europe, guidelines have been established to say how often this should be done. And so it's recommended that a culture for NTM, and this has to be sent specifically to look for NTM, be done once a year in all of those who are able to expectorate or to produce a sputum sample. One really depends on a sputum sample or a bronchoscopy, but the bronchs are relatively rare these days in most centers. So a sputum sample is needed to look for these bacteria. And so here we have the U.S. registry data, the most recent data set that's been released. These are from 2017. You can see there on the vertical axis the percent of individuals in the U.S. This covers about 95% of everyone with CF in the U.S. And across the bottom, moving to the right, are increasing ages. So the percent of those who can produce sputum is shown in blue, and then just below that, those who are screened for NTM in that year. First thing I'll point out here is that our younger patients, those roughly 10 years old and younger, often can't produce sputum. And so we don't have a lot of good information about how common NTM may be occurring in their airways. But the data we have suggests it's not very common. So we're not terribly worried about that group. But we are missing a pretty good chunk here who don't get screened. The other point I'll make from this slide is that in 2017, about half of all people in the U.S. with CF had a culture sent for mycobacteria, and just over 13% of those in that time frame grew either one of these MAC or abscesses. So that's relatively high. I think we need to be focused on understanding what that infection is all about and how best to treat it. A common question that then we're faced is this. So Doc, does it matter where I live in regards to potential risk of getting one of these NTM infections? A study was published in 2018 looking at the U.S. again. Here, the colors in blue and green, the darker colors, are states that have higher prevalence of this. These are CF data, by the way. So you can see if you consider any NTM, it's pretty widely distributed. You might argue a little bit of a predilection to southern states more than northern states, but that's definitely not universal. But if we shift to the specific infections, MAC, it does appear that there's increased rates of MAC here out west. And abscesses seems to be seen more often in the southeast, and in particular in Hawaii. So perhaps those with warmer and wetter climates see more of this abscesses. The states with the highest reported prevalence, so for avium, again out west, you can see the list there. Hawaii is included in that, and then abscesses, Florida, Louisiana, and again Hawaii. I will say, though, these data have to be caveated a little bit. They're dependent on how good that state is at screening for NTM, right? And so we have to be a little bit careful about overinterpreting these data. But it does seem that there may be some effect on the local environment, particularly the climate in that region, and which of these mycobacteria one may be exposed to. This is supported, too, by differences we see across the globe. So here in North America, we see more of that MAC strain, and over in Europe, they see quite a lot more of Mycobacterium abscessus. So there do seem to be some distinctions based on geography, and that'll actually come up a little bit later. Perhaps more importantly, though, this study looked over a five-year period in the U.S., and during that five-year period, one out of five people with CF grew one of these two bacteria, suggesting that we need to keep a close eye on that. And even more so, they saw a modest increase in time over that 5 years. So in 2011, the overall prevalence rate was 10%, and that increased to just over 13% by 2014. Now, I just showed you the most recent registry data we have from 2017 was almost exactly the same as this number. So that suggests that we may have leveled off, but we haven't seen a decline, a decrease in the prevalence rates of the mycobacteria. So besides geography or what are my potential risk factors and exposure, the other common question that we're faced with is this. What about person-to-person spread? So Mycobacteria NTM is part of your infection control policy here, and I would fully support that. But I think we still have a lot to learn about the specific risk factors or how likely it is to be spreading these between individuals or contaminated surfaces. There were several landmark publications in the last few years that really highlighted this concern for the community. The group out of Cambridge in the UK published a report that strongly suggested they had some spread within their CF program. There was a big study published in Science looking at a number of isolates collected all over the globe, suggesting that all of these different isolates were very related, which is very interesting and a little bit hard to interpret. I'll revisit that in a moment. Very recently, a report out of an Australian pediatric center suggesting some significant spread in their program, and there have been some other reports. One of the earliest ones was actually out of our program in Seattle. So this figure kind of nicely encapsulates the question that we're wrestling with. The paradigm for a long time has been really shown there on the left, and I told you that these bugs tend to live in water and soil. They're spread throughout our natural environments, and the idea was that individuals acquire their unique NTM infection from that local environment. But DNA sequencing at a high fidelity level has been a great tool in research, and we've been able to ask how closely related on a genetic basis are these different infections. We can collect those in the lab and fully sequence the genome and ask that question. And those recent publications I just noted have really challenged that long-held paradigm that suggests that everyone was acquiring these individually, and have rather suggested that there may be some direct spread from one person to another, either through direct contact or a contaminated surface. I really like this review in Nature by Michael and Davidson. They had this nice quote. They said, "Hypotheses that challenge paradigms are essential for scientific progress, but also warrant careful follow-up." So I'll give you my opinion and what I understand in this space of NTM. I think we still don't clearly understand precisely the exposure risks, and that includes our natural environment or hobbies such as gardening. I think many caution against hot tubs, for example, but haven't been really good studies yet quite to demonstrate the risk there. I think that common sense does have a role to play in some of this. That extends, though, that lack of clear information does extend to these shared spaces and person-to-person contact. So people have reported these genetically highly similar dominant clones, almost exactly the same genome. And when you can do that, and you can also demonstrate how those people have been in contact or have been in the clinic at a very similar time, then that does suggest that this person-to-person spread can occur. But some of these studies have looked at those genomes and found these very similar looking genomes in collections across countries, even continents, and they've been collected many years apart. There's a group of abscesses from a plastic surgery clinic in South America that look very much like the infections that are seen in CF people in Europe, and that's really hard to explain or understand that. So there may be some complexity in this NTM world that makes it harder to use this particular type of science to understand that potential risk. For those of you who may be concerned about NTM, or even those of you who are not, I just want to highlight some of the research. A lot of attention is being focused on NTM as an important part of CF, and we think that if anything, that could increase in this modulator area that we're so excited about. So the CF Foundation and we at the TDN are working through a study called PREDICT. This is led by Stacy Martiniano at Children's Hospital in Colorado. It's really focused on this question. All right, so my culture is growing one of these mycobacteria. What does that mean? And how do I know when that's really affecting my health? That's a key question that we have to understand. And that's closely related to a second study called PATIENTS, which is led by Jerry Nick out of National Jewish in Denver. Okay, so we've decided, based on criteria, that this is causing lung damage. How do we treat it? And let's treat it all in a very similar fashion so we can begin to understand how well that treatment is working. This, in other words, testing standard of care. We can also ask how well people tolerate, or frankly do not tolerate, treatment for NTM, because often it can be quite challenging. Once we have this background of standardized approach to diagnosis and treatment, then we can layer on top of that some even more exciting questions, such as, okay, there are new drugs that may work against mycobacteria. Might they work for those who are failing to respond to the standard of care? Or perhaps they may work even better than standard of care, or perhaps they're better tolerated, have less side effects. So many plans are already in process to develop some of those studies. There's this interesting question, too, that may emerge. So, okay, I have one of these infections. I don't want to wait and see if it causes health trouble. I want to try to get rid of it. The hard part about doing that now is that the treatment is actually fairly toxic. It's very long, and I won't go into the details of what NTM treatment looks like for the sake of time. But if we can identify effective therapies that are pretty well tolerated and perhaps short, then I think the idea of eradication studies becomes even more attractive. And this is not just theoretical. There are a number of drugs that are already working this direction, studies even starting. I'll just name a few here. Bedaquilin is a drug that's developed for extended drug-resistant TB. Seems to have significant properties that work against non-tuberculous mycobacteria. Gallium, GM-CSF, is a way to boost one's own immune system to try to deal with that infection. We'll see if that may help. May be helpful. Nitric oxide would be another. So I told you a lot of this work was centered and started in Colorado, but it's already been expanded to 10 centers across the U.S. At 8 cities. And one big goal here is to refine the process that has been pretty effective in Colorado so it can be applied across the United States and then eventually with partners across the globe so we can have regional experts who can help those who may be struggling with these infections. Let's then shift to the second topic, this small colony variant Staph aureus, type of Staph aureus. I want to begin by giving a lot of credit to Dan Wolter and Luke Hoffman, some of my colleagues in Seattle, who've been very kind in sharing a lot of the data I'll present to you here and, and material for slides. I should also, I don't know if Luke is in the room, he was just promoted to full professor at the university this month, which is a big deal, so I'll congratulate him for that. Yeah. As the name suggests, small colony variants are really just defined by how they grow in the laboratory. They form these very small colonies, and often they have to be grown on specific kinds of media that are not necessarily part of the routine kind of identification and growth process in clinical labs. They've been isolated for the most part from chronic infections, so they seem to be selected for and infections that are persisting, and they're found for a lot of different bacteria and fungus, but perhaps they're best characterized for Staphylococcus. And so in our world, we think about Staph aureus. Staph aureus small colony variants, they very clearly seem to be developing by selective mutation, so survival of the fittest, if you want to call it that. And they have these mutations in key processes in the cell that relate to growth. And so that explains why they grow so slowly and they're small, and they depend on certain nutrients in the media. This is important because they can be very hard to identify. And so we really don't know how common they may or may not be, and that's where a lot of the attention is currently being focused. That's also, I'm falling off a little bit on the slides there. That's also important because these small colony variants, unlike the staph that they derive from, are resistant to a lot of antibiotics. And these include antibiotics that we commonly use to treat staph, such as sulfonamides or Bactrim. It's also important because some of these drugs in the laboratory can select or create these small colony variants. So it may be that we're causing some of this by the antibiotics we choose to use. So a model for this, a very simple model, would look something like this. One has Staph aureus and they acquire it in their lung, and then it's exposed over a period of time to a number of conditions. Some of those may be antibiotics, such as the sulfonamides I mentioned, or perhaps co-infections, other bacteria, and other conditions that exist within the CF airway, and then that can select for these small colony variant forms. That again is important because they grow more slowly, they don't respond to antibiotics very well, and they can be difficult to identify under our usual clinical practices. So I think that begs the question, well, how common are these SCVs? These are the Staph aureus data from the registry. Again, on the vertical axis is the percent of individuals. On the bottom, is, in this case, is actually time marching forward through to 2017. It's notable that staph has increased over time, and that may be in part related to decreasing Pseudomonas and other infections that tend to beat out the staph. So I don't think staph is likely to go away in the modulator-treated world, and I think this will remain an important issue we need to keep an eye on. MRSA has obviously received a lot of attention, not just in CF, but in the lay press. MRSA rates are relatively high in the U.S., much higher than they are in Europe, and they seem to have leveled off around 25%. We do not know what the SCV rates are, but there are some small center data, and I'm going to show you those to suggest they may be pretty high. So several years ago now, a group in Germany looked at their center, and this included both children and adults at the time, about 80 people. And they looked for a three-year period. And during that 3 years, about 70% of their population grew staph. Half of those people during that 3 years grew a small colony variant. They basically put in place into their laboratory the culture methods needed to identify those. Some years later, 100, again, children and adults were looked at in Switzerland during just a three-month period. And almost half grew staph, and about one out of five of those during that 3 months grew a small colony variant. And then Luke and his group more recently did a two-year study with our children in Seattle looking at 100 of them. They found Staph aureus in close to 90% over that 2 years. Over a quarter of those in our population who were doing generally well grew these small colony variants. It's important too that those who were growing these small colony variants weren't doing as well as our children who were not. So this is called an association. We can't attribute causality. We can't say that the small colony variants are making them worse, but we need to pay close attention to that and understand if that may be true. They also found, when looking at those children who grew small colony variants there in Seattle, if they had been treated with Bactrim, that trimethoprim sulfur methoxazole, during the last quarter, they were almost 10 times more likely to to grow these small colony variants. And Luke and Dan and the others have a paper coming out very soon that explains why this is the case, and it clearly appears that exposure to Bactrim may be causing some of these. They did follow that up then with a multi-center study, not just Seattle. They looked at 5 programs over 2 years, almost 250 children at this point, saw the very similar rates. 28% of children were found to have small colony variants, and those children who had that were not doing as well as the children who did not. And that association with not doing as well was even stronger than the association with growing Pseudomonas or MRSA, some infections that we pay a lot of attention to. So in my view, at this point, we see that this is probably pretty common, but we really don't know, and I think it needs more attention. And it may be developing in the lungs, either due to the conditions in the lungs or perhaps the antibiotic choices that we're making. We do have other options to treat staph infections besides the sulfonamides, and perhaps we need to think a little more carefully about that, because growing these is associated with poor outcomes. We don't know if that's causing those poor outcomes, but it may, and we need to focus on that as well. With that, then, let's shift to the last topic, and that is this question of how can we best use some of our most common antibiotics? And I want to begin with chronic azithromycin. Maybe a quick show of hands. You or your family member take this. It's often Monday, Wednesday, Friday tablet. Yeah, so a fair number in the room. This is a very commonly employed therapy, I think in part because it is relatively easy to take, which I think is great. But what we have long wrestled with is the question of whether or not the benefits of that persist. People have been doing this for over a decade now. And like a lot of drugs, we don't know if that continues to be helpful over time. To get to that, I just want to quickly remind everyone in the room why we use this drug. So Lisa Saman and several colleagues back in 2003, several years ago now, studied azithromycin for a 6-month period. They did this in mainly young adults who had Pseudomonas infection, and they had an impaired lung function. The average was about 70%. What they saw was a fairly modest, but an increase in lung function over that 6-month period, which was encouraging. They also saw a decreased risk of having an exacerbation event in that population, a decrease by about a third of having that event over that 6-month period. So based on that, a lot of people began using this therapy in CF. Frankly, we didn't have a whole lot of options back then. And some years later, they studied the population who were not infected with Pseudomonas. These were generally children, mean age of about 10. They had normal lung function, FEV1 of 100%. Again, looking for 6 months, in this group, they didn't see a benefit to lung function, but they saw a reduced risk of exacerbation, almost half. as many were having these exacerbation events, although overall that population didn't have nearly as many events as the Pseudomonas infected group did. And then very recently, my colleagues in Seattle, Nicole Hamblett and Bonnie Ramsey, did a study looking at even younger population, 7-year-olds who recently grew Pseudomonas. And they found that they also had a decreased risk of exacerbation over time by almost 50%. So based on these positive studies and also endorsement in clinical care guidelines, this is a very common medication we use in people with CF. About 70% of people who have Pseudomonas infection in the US registry are prescribed this drug. That's one of the highest prescription rates for any of our drugs. But there have been some single center reports trickling out over the years to say, hey, maybe this only lasts for a year, and maybe we shouldn't keep people on azithromycin for a long time. Here's a study out of the Netherlands, 54 children. So this was looking at the change in lung function year to year. And so below the horizontal line is negative, is not what you want to see. Basically, they were showing that once you get after that first year of therapy, the rate of decline in lung function or the loss of lung function per year was the same in years 2 and 3 as it was before they started the drug. Another study looking at 68 children, again, similar kind of pattern. The rate of decline in that year before starting azithromycin was about the same as they saw once they got past that first year of azithromycin use. And a small study in adults who were infected with Pseudomonas aeruginosa, They were reporting on the need for oral antibiotics or exacerbation events, and they reported the rate was about the same the year before starting the drug as it was the second and third year that they used these drugs. So these are a handful of actually relatively small studies at single centers, and they all suggested that the benefit of azithromycin may last for about 12 months. And here we are using it for over a decade, and I think that's an important question. It can be very hard, though, because it is simply not practical. It is perhaps not even ethical to say we're going to take hundreds of people with CF, we're going to randomize them to azithromycin or a placebo and follow you for 5 or 10 years. That really isn't something that we can do feasibly. And so what do we do to try to get at some of these questions? One approach is to use this resource of the registry. And clearly the registry has some warts, but it also can be extremely valuable to, in questions like this. Because we monitor drug use over time by clinical prescription. We also monitor certain outcomes pretty well, such as changes in lung function and the need for IV antibiotic therapy. And so I'll give a lot of credit to Sonia Helci and 4 statisticians who helped with this over a 2-year period. We've just finished up some of that analysis, so I'll share that with you. We basically took those in the registry, a 10-year period ending just now, and we defined when did they start using azithromycin and stay on it consistently for 3 years. We then separated those or grouped them into those who were infected with Pseudomonas and those who were not, because they've been studied at different groups in those studies. And then we found people in the registry who looked almost exactly like them, based on a number of parameters that I'll show you. And we matched them because they were not prescribed azithromycin. So here we have what's called a historical randomization approach. You basically find people who look exactly the same as far as you can tell, and for whatever reason they used a drug or didn't. And that's how you can try to get at some of this. We looked at what I mentioned, so their decline in lung function over time and then the need for IV antibiotics. So I'll show you the data in a moment. But the first explanation, so to speak, is I'm gonna show you data of about 800 people. And many of you know the registry has over 30,000 people. Why in the world am I getting down to just 800? There's a scientific principle that I just want to make sure everyone in the room understands leaving today, and that's indication bias. So for registries, or whenever we look in those single center reports, for example, we want to ask the impact of an intervention, and that intervention is not placed by randomization. We didn't say, okay, you get this and you get placebo, but rather using that drug is based on a clinical decision. That almost always is confounded. There's a bias in that, right? And so let's think, for example, someone who's not infected with Pseudomonas, what do the studies say it helps with? It's exacerbation rate. So if you have a child that you're caring for, or your child, and they're exacerbating a lot, they're much more likely to get put on azithromycin than someone who's hardly ever exacerbating. And that can really mess with our ability to understand cause and effect, and I'll show you that. But we are able, because of the beautiful size and the detailed follow-up in the registry, to match these people up. So here I'll just show you some of that. You can see those with Pseudomonas on the left and those without on the right. And so just highlighting a few of these, lung function almost identical, the use of medications almost identical, comorbidities such as diabetes almost identical. We also matched on the number of exacerbations they had been having and a number of other parameters. We basically selected 14 parameters we thought could perhaps affect their lung function decline. So the need for IV antibiotics, this is that group who are not infected with Pseudomonas. There on the left, the shading doesn't really come through, but on the left, you can see that those who were on azithromycin were actually much more likely to get IV antibiotics than those who were not. But that is not the matched population. That clearly shows that indication bias that I was taking some time to walk through today. Once we match them to those who look almost exactly the same as them, that goes away. And really there's no difference in the need for IV antibiotics in those who aren't infected with Pseudomonas. It's important to say that those clinical trials did not really show benefit against the need for IV antibiotics. Those exacerbation benefits were pretty mild exacerbations, usually treated with oral or inhaled therapy. And so this is consistent with what those trials showed. When we shift to the Pseudomonas infected population, we don't see as much indication bias because it's so commonly used in that population. Those who have Pseudomonas infection are very commonly given azithromycin regardless of the number of exacerbations they're having. But we also don't see a real protection or benefit against these IV treatment events with azithromycin use, at least in these analyses. If we shift to the decline over a three-year period, I showed you that the Pseudomonas infected group, they had a bump, and that was measured for 6 months, and the non-Pseudomonas infected group didn't have any real effect on FEV1. And so we can say that, okay, if you extend that out beyond 6 months to 3 years, we still don't see a benefit to lung function. We don't see a slower rate of decline. Azithromycin is shown in red here, and the non-azithromycin users in black. However, when we look at those with Pseudomonas infection, we actually see a pretty dramatic slowing of the rate of decline in lung function across at least a three-year period. That was almost 40% slower. And that frankly wasn't too much less than what Steve highlighted earlier with ivacaftor. So this is relatively large effect over time in that group who are infected with Pseudomonas. And that's a reassuring, I think, because we have a drug very commonly used and used for a long time in those with Pseudomonas infection. These data suggest that benefit may be durable at least for 3 years. So these are retrospective. I think it's important to acknowledge that. This is not a randomized trial, but we went to great pains to try to control for some of the issues with retrospective data. And we do see some findings that are consistent with previous trials, suggesting some limited benefit in certain population, but a sustained benefit to lung function in those who have Pseudomonas infection. And we cannot comment. There may be a sustained benefit to not needing as many oral antibiotic courses, those mild exacerbations. Those, unfortunately, are not as well captured in the registry, and so that's why we didn't ask that question. You can imagine a lot of people call in to the clinic, they're prescribed antibiotics. It's hard to get those data into the registry, and so we're not as able to look at that. So I've explained to you that azithromycin may actually be pretty good for those with Pseudomonas infection, and I think that is true, but I want to also acknowledge we've been studying a concern over a drug-drug interaction that may also be quite common, and so I'll briefly walk through this. And that's with tobramycin, specifically inhaled tobramycin is also very common in our patient population. You can see in green, and this is layered on top of the azithromycin use in red. In those who have Pseudomonas infection, these drugs are used at about 70% of the time, and they're very commonly used together. We know from some other studies, those on inhaled tobramycin use azithromycin about 75% of the time. So a lot of combined use. We've published some studies here in the last few years based on some lab work where we observed that there might be trouble with these two drugs together, suggesting that maybe the combination isn't good for people with CF. So we basically went back and reanalyzed trials that compared inhaled tobramycin to another drug, aztreonam, which goes by Casdin. It's a different class of antibiotic. And we said, all right, those who were in the trial, if they were on azithromycin, did they do differently than those who weren't on azithromycin? And so you can see this is lung function above or going up above the horizontal line is what you want to see. It's an improvement. So in the black and the gray, that's the aztreonam or the Casdin arm. And those on azithromycin did about the same. That's the gray versus the black. But if they were randomized to get tobramycin in that study, the users of azithromycin didn't do so well. Those who didn't use azithromycin seemed to do just fine. Another study looking at the same people, they did a month of inhaled tobramycin immediately followed by a month of inhaled aztreonam. So we can look in the same individuals. We see the same kind of same general effect where on the left there, those are the people in the study who were using azithromycin during their inhaled tobramycin month. They didn't do as well. They seemed to catch up during that inhaled aztreonam month. And those who didn't use azithromycin seemed to do pretty similarly with either drug. Same pattern is seen when we asked about symptoms. These are respiratory symptoms. This is a questionnaire based on quality of life. Same pattern you can see where those who were on azithromycin and got tobramycin in the study didn't have a nice improvement or reduction in their symptoms. Similarly, the same effects seen in the other trial. The big registry study I just mentioned to you, we tried to ask or extend to this question as well. And so we found a group who were using inhaled tobramycin on and off. They weren't cycling continuous therapy. They were just on tobramycin. And in that group, they didn't seem to get this bump from azithromycin. But those who were doing Casdin on and off or inhaled aztreonam lysine, did seem to get that similar bump that we saw when we looked at the azithromycin benefit over time. It was about the same, so that suggested that is worth noting. It's challenging because tobramycin is a really great drug, and one of my key mentors is one of the people who have developed this drug in CF. So I'm not here to poke holes at any drug. I just am here to explain how using these antibiotics can be more complicated than we sometimes originally think. It's specifically concerning to me, though, because IV tobramycin is by far the most common antibiotic we use when someone needs IVs and they're infected with Pseudomonas. And getting around that may be pretty tricky. In other words, coming up with a suitable alternative to IV tobramycin isn't straightforward. So we did ask this question. We used a big single center in Denver. They had over 220 exacerbations. These are adults. And those who were on azithromycin and they went in the hospital and got IV tob, they had a recovery during their IV treatment of 2.5% less than those who were not on azithromycin. And if instead they were treated with IV colistin, which is colistimethate or a different class of drug, the users of azithromycin actually had a 2% better recovery than the non-users of azithromycin. So these are not definitive data, but they're all consistent with the same concern. There may be a selective adverse drug interaction happening. And all of this is really association and post hoc and retrospective. So I want to be careful to not oversell it. But I do want to say it was based not on some random observation. It was based on lab observation of concern about these two drugs in combination. So this is a standard Pseudomonas growth plate. This is courtesy of Colin Manoil and Sam Lee, also colleagues in genome sciences there at University of Washington. So these are discs with antibiotics in them. And the A is azithromycin, the T is tobramycin. This is how we measure sensitivity or resistance often to growth. And if you combine those or put the azithromycin close to the tobramycin, you get this area where they start to merge and you start to inhibit the ability of that tobramycin to kill there near the azithromycin. Or you can grow these out into what's called late stationary phase where they're no longer replicating as much. And this may be more similar to some conditions in the CF airway. You can dilute them as you go from top to bottom. They're more dilute cultures. And so you get to a point at the bottom where you're not growing much. And then going from left over to right, you have increasing amounts of tobramycin in those cultures. So you get this nice dose-dependent killing effect in this model. But what happens if we add azithromycin to that same culture condition? This is what we see, where it appears that that whole killing virtually is wiped out. And that's a real concern to us. You can also do this in a time-dependent kill fashion, looking over time. And so you can see in this culture where tobramycin alone, it's over 4-log killing. It's very efficient killing. But if we look at and compare with the conditions where we have no antibiotic or azithromycin alone or that same tobramycin plus the azithromycin, we seem to wipe out that killing effect. So what I can say is that in the lab, we can see clear antagonism between these two drugs. And we repeatedly find this in post hoc, kind of going back to the data and analyzing it for reasons it wasn't originally designed for, but being able to ask some questions about combined use. We see this also with IV use in large single centers, and now with the registry data that I showed you. Can't forget, though, azithromycin alone seems to be quite good for people who are infected with Pseudomonas. So I'm not here to pick a winner. I'm just suggesting that we need to watch this potential combined use a little more because they are quite common. And so some colleagues and I have been leading a prospective dedicated study to try to figure this out once and for all. It's called the TEACH trial, supported by the NIH and the CF Foundation. And we hope to be done with that study by the end of this year and we'll be able to share our results next year. And hope to state some of our conclusions more definitively with that. I've alluded to some of this already, but there are real questions we need to address if we do prove that our hypothesis is correct. And that's really this: are there suitable alternatives to avoid this combined use interaction, or is it possible to use both at the same time? I'm sorry, to use both drugs in an individual, but just not at the same time. And so both of these will be follow-up questions depending on our results from our study. So with that, I'm going to wrap up. I want to thank you for your attention. I know we're getting toward the end of the day. We think of non-tuberculous mycobacteria. This has been a persistent and growing concern, but I do want to highlight a lot of good research is going into this space. I think we're going to understand how well our treatment is working, and we're going to find drugs that work even better. So I'm excited to watch that in the coming years. This issue of contagion is real. We need to be concerned about it, but we also need to better understand what is the reality, what is the likelihood of that actually happening. The small colony variant staff, Dr. Hoffman and colleagues, are helping us focus more on this. I think that's important and should get greater attention. And especially because it seems to be found in our youngest and healthiest population, that population may really explode in the modulator space. And so I don't think this issue is going to go away. And we need to understand, especially if we're causing problems just by the antibiotics we choose. And that really leads to the third point, which is the use of popular antibiotics. So azithromycin does seem to have some long-lasting benefit. I'm glad to see that because people have been doing it for a long time. A lot of us have. But we need to be concerned about potential interactions with other drugs. And that doesn't just exist in these two drugs. We need to think about all of our polypharmacy and how we best manage our patients. So thank you very much. I want to thank Siri and the organizers, especially for an invitation to come out today and to spend some time with you. A large number of folks have been involved in this work that I highlighted today. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Talk. So please correct me if I'm wrong, but NTM causes roughly double the rate of decline. And we know that if you culture initially more than one organism, the likelihood of the development of lung disease is much higher. And yet our guidelines as they stand today are that after repeat culture, we wait for ATS guideline criteria to be met before treating. And I'm wondering if that guideline as it stands is not really considering the patient assessment of risk and benefit, and that really that's a physician assessment of risk and benefit. If you take diseases, for example, like breast cancer and women who have the positive BRCA gene, they're presented with the information, this is your risk of having cancer, do you want a prophylactic mastectomy? Whereas in CF, I feel like there's less respect for patient agency in those decision making, you know, and I'm just concerned about the guidelines as they stand and that there's not that shared decision making. I just want to know what you think.
Thank you for the question. This alludes to a lot of what we didn't really get into the talk, but I'll try to summarize. So when one grows one of these NTM infections in a respiratory sample, there are guidelines that have been developed to try to understand if that is damaging your health and you should be treated. And just very briefly to note that treatment typically involves 12 weeks of continuous IV antibiotics followed by another 18 months of multiple oral antibiotics, and many people who are treated develop irreversible side effects and damage to hearing and other conditions. So the decision to treat is not one that is made lightly. But that being said, with full consent and understanding, I think patients' perspective and whether or not they want to be treated and how aggressive or conservative they may be in starting treatment are an important part of that shared decision making. I will say that the work I highlighted, the PREDICT and the patient's trial, are trying to address some of your concern, meaning how well are the guidelines applying to people who have CF, because the guidelines were developed in part outside of CF and have been adopted. They are reaching that time from initial first culture infection to making a diagnosis and starting treatment much more quickly than we historically have. And that is happening by applying a systematic approach to making that diagnosis. And so while we don't want to delay treatment, we also don't want to treat people unnecessarily. And so the last thing I just want to say, and I'll be happy to take a follow-up question, is that very often when someone grows one of these infections, that receives a lot of attention, perhaps as it should, but sometimes there can be a tendency to not treat the rest of the CF as aggressively as one would. And so very often, simply maximizing the rest of CF care, they're finding in long-term follow-up, those patients didn't need to be treated, they've returned to their baseline and are stable. So it's challenging.
All of that is understood, but it is still the patient's decision. They should be respected for their agency, and I don't think the guidelines do that, and I don't think the CF community does that. I don't know why, compared to other diseases. I wonder if it's because CF was a pediatric disease by and large until just recently, but I think we need to put more emphasis on shared decision-making and patient assessment of risk and benefit, not physician.
Thank you for the comment.
So I'm post-transplant, and along those same lines of everything you were just discussing, a little over a year ago, I cultured an NTM that we didn't know which one, so we sent it away for 7 weeks of testing, so it never got that back. But I also had a Pseudomonas and a fungal infection at the same time, so while we were waiting for the culture, we treated those two, and then when we checked on my cultures after those treatments were done, the NTM didn't show again. Is that something that may have been taken care of with the other drugs, or can it lie dormant, and is it something I should still be checking for?
Yeah. So thank you for sharing your experience. I'm obviously reluctant to comment on your individual care, but I think in generalities, the single center report out of Denver, good number of patients found that about a third of people would only culture these once, and then they wouldn't see it again, at least for a very long time. We always worry that perhaps we're not sampling and we're not finding it still down there. I think that's the concern, right? But through serial cultures, especially if one is able to produce sputum, we're increasingly comfortable in saying that it isn't there. And that they've, and through those fancy genetics, they've been able to demonstrate that oftentimes when they culture one, say 18 or 24 or 36 months later, is not the same one that they had way back in. So it is reinfection rather than just not finding it. Whether or not treating the other infections contributed to clearing that is hard to say. You know, I think airway clearance alone could play a role in that, but I'm thrilled to hear that it doesn't seem to be growing. Yeah.
Hello, thank you for this very informative presentation. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about where bisepatia fits in, the NTM information that you shared with us and your take on just bisepatia.
Yeah, thank you. Burkholderia sepatia is a group of bacteria now. Cyanosepatia would be a subset of Burkholderia sepatia and seems to be associated in certain populations with more rapid clinical decline or loss of health, as you may be aware. Rates of Burkholderia seem to be modestly lower than we see with NTM, but are very important for those individuals who are infected with them, primarily because Burkholderia is inherently resistant to a lot of antibiotics, and so also can be quite difficult to treat, and especially when considering oral or inhaled options, they're very limited, so treatment may often require IV therapy, and responses may not be as good as we would like. I can comment and say that periodically, and perhaps more so in years past, we've seen these kind of waves of breakouts, a lot of spread, and pretty rapid health decline in breakouts of Burkholderia, and that has led to changes in infection control policies at some centers that seems to have worked, but some of those waves still seem to come through. In my view, Burkholderia for a single individual doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to do worse. It gets a little bit complicated because some of that may be predicted based on what kind of Burkholderia a person has. Multivorins, for example, doesn't seem to to associate with those decline episodes as much as Cenosepatia does. But I think it is appropriate for centers to be careful about infection control policies. And not all centers do this, but some centers will see people with Burkholderia at the end of the clinic or even on a separate clinic day, just of the concern that we have seen more, a greater tendency for spread in some of those infections. Beyond that, I'll just admit that I'm not an expert in Burkholderia, and that's all I can say.
Yeah. Thank you.
I just had a question. So it was really interesting, the interaction between azithromycin and terbamycin. I'm curious, though, if there's other studies or research that you know of looking at other antibiotic interactions that could potentially be something we need to be aware of.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. None come to mind about concerns of interaction. We have paid quite a bit of attention recently to what drugs may or may not affect the modulators, right? So these are a new class of agents coming in, and there have been some challenges, particularly in some of the earlier modulators, with drug interactions, including some antibiotics. And so that was mentioned earlier in the day, and that has received attention. I'm not aware of studies, though they very well may be occurring, and I'm just not privy to them, of looking specifically at drug-drug interactions beyond that at this point. So, as I said, though, I think that we do need to be conscious of that possibility, especially given the number of drugs that many of our patients are asked to take.
Hi, thank you. Hi. For a lovely presentation. I'm finding that the better treatments that we have, that we're keeping our kids healthy longer, and they're not sputum producers.
Yeah.
And so would you recommend bronchoscopy annually on those kids?
Yeah, thanks for a great and very difficult question. I actually meant to highlight that. I don't think it'll just be the kids. Based on the GOAL study that Steve highlighted this morning in his talk, so many of those patients who previously could expectorate, they go on these highly effective modulators, they cannot. And that's great, right? I mean, that's an improved quality of life and a sign that they're doing better, but it also makes it challenging when we think about screening procedures. What I would say is that bronchoscopy may not be the necessary step and comes with its own risks and costs, et cetera. I think that for some that may have an important role, but induced sputum maneuvers are done in people who don't have CF and don't routinely expectorate to collect a sputum sample. I do believe that our clinics are going to need to be very thoughtful about the logistics of trying to obtain induced sputum samples, maybe not every quarter, I don't know, I'm not making the guidelines, but with some frequency, so we can still continue to screen, because we screen to identify infections early, believing that we can address them early. And I think this isn't just NTM, but also early acquisition of Pseudomonas and eradication, things like that. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it's very interesting, everything you said. Thanks so much for the information. I have two daughters with cystic fibrosis and one has MAC. And so the exacerbation she had in seventh grade, she's now 22. But I'm just wondering, in that vein of talking about it, and she's decided not to have the treatment yet based on the information she got for her doctor, she's waiting. Mm-hmm. And I've heard a lot of good about Colorado's facilities, and we're at the University of Michigan. So what do you think, or what is your generic advice, not pertaining to my kids, obviously, mm-hmm. but do you think we need more conversation, more information at the clinics? Because we still don't know a lot about it, even though she's dealing with, mm-hmm. you know, with it, mm-hmm. and kind of exactly what choices to make.
Well, I'll begin by saying Michigan is full of wonderful ID specialists, including Dr. Lapuma and others. Lindsay Caverly is one of the patients and predict site PIs there at Michigan. I'm a researcher. I'm always in favor of more information and discussion. I think that that's good. It's all about prioritizing one's time and focus. But if you believe that awareness of NTM or even processes are not yet ideal at your center, I think almost all centers would invite a conversation about that and what you perceive as perhaps some gaps there, especially if you think you might have some way to help with that. So, thanks. Yeah.
Hi. I'm wondering what your thoughts are around M. abscesses and transplantation, because there is actually, I'm from Vancouver in Canada, and our center will not transplant somebody that has M. abscesses.
Yeah.
So any data on that or thoughts?
I don't believe there are clear data. There are clearly reports of poor outcomes in after transplant of those who go in infected with Mycobacterium abscessus, that one in particular. And to my knowledge, there may only be one transplant center in the U.S. Willing to evaluate those patients. These decisions largely exist in the transplant programs. So my ray of hope, so to speak, is that the foundation and others are organizing a lot of coordinated research now around the transplant world that hasn't really been there, and at least in our CF space. And so we will begin to learn more. I can't comment on the appropriateness of transplanting those patients, though I can clearly understand the complexity, if not some desperation there. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks very much.